Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the June 30th edition of Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. And we are close to celebrating the 4th of July, so I'd like to wish everybody a safe and happy Independence Day weekend. And hopefully weather won't kill you guys down, those of you that are suffering with it down south, like my two co-hosts. What's it been like down there?
It's brutal.
How hot was it down there today, Jerry?
Bobby, it wasn't real bad, probably 93, 94.
It's about what it was up here today. It's just, I mean, they said on the weather last night, it said it's not going to be as bad tomorrow. The humidity will be down. But I've just about figured out I don't care if it's wet, dry. If it's 94, it's 94.
Thank you. In the south, that humidity is going to be there. I don't care what they say.
Oh, goodness, it was warm.
And what about you, Mike? You still wearing a windbreaker or what?
No, I think it got up to 80 today. It was a little bit warmer the last couple of days. It's been in the mid-80s. But it's, of course, even though we're close to the Hudson River up here, the humidity is nowhere near as bad. We had a bad rainstorm night before last, thunder and lightning. But other than that, finally the rain has moved out, and I'm hoping it stays out through at least to get the circus in, because I don't want to go through another hailstorm right before showtime. That's nerve-wracking.
What's it like at night up there now?
Mid-60s, low-60s, something like that.
Oh, excuse me. I'm ready for the winter. I don't know about you guys.
Not up here. I don't want to get caught up here in the winter.
No. Well, Bobby, are your Falcons going to play this year, or what are they going
to
do?
You know, I really don't know. They talk in the paper, and you know that they're getting close, that they're getting, you know, but they're supposed to go to camp here in 3 weeks, and they just, I don't know. I'm afraid even if they settle it now, so many people are going to get hurt where they haven't trained. I'm sure
they're doing it on their own.
I hope they are.
They say that the owners can make these boys scream. You know, they're going to start wanting those paychecks.
Well, I was going to say, they only get paid once they start playing. So let them miss a paycheck or two, and I think they're going to be a lot more willing to negotiate.
I'm
all for them. They need to get what they can while they can. But I also have seen the other side of running a business like that, man. All the liability and all the other part of it's on the other end too. So
they have no idea what it costs to run that.
No, none whatsoever.
I mean, I don't either. When you start talking about an NFL team, I mean, I really don't. I mean, I can't fathom.
You've seen both sides of a promotion. You know what it is. And being perfectly honest, most guys in the business had no clue.
They didn't have a hint what
no.
went on.
And couldn't understand why you'd scream at them, stay in the ring.
Exactly.
Oh.
The players will have help, though, because all the clubs in Buckhead will start suffering once the players can't afford to come out and party.
Yeah.
Start putting pressure on the owners, and they'll get that to happen. I just can't imagine making that much money. And then I'm like Bobby, they need to, as far as some stuff like that, I can understand the wanting to want more and all that, but I just cannot imagine playing football for months out of the year and making the millions of dollars some of these guys make.
Well, let them go ahead and get a real job.
I was fixing to say, yeah, go down to the QT and pump gas and see what it's all about.
I mean, you know, I know they draw the money, and they're making more than they ever dreamed they would make, and they begrudge the owners of, you know, if they don't make a profit, they can't pay them. That's how stupid they are. Look at the L.A. Dodgers, the mess they're in.
Yes. You know, Jerry's a little older than me, but we grew up during a time frame where we can remember, and you too, Michael, we can remember when everybody wanted to play for the Dodgers because it was the best run organization in the world, or they said it was.
Absolutely.
And now, you know, they're afraid they can't make payroll.
Can you imagine making that payroll?
Oh, geez.
Mm. They get paid every 2 weeks.
I'm not sure it's still in print, but I had, I think I'm still got it somewhere, but I read Tommy Lasorda's book back when he was still manager of the Dodgers. It was called The Artful Dodger. And being a Braves fan, you know, that's one of the reasons back in the early 80s when I moved there, when you could buy a general admission ticket and sit behind home plate because nobody went to the games. I always tried to make the Dodgers games because I always knew Tommy Lasorda sooner or later would get thrown out of the game. But what a character he was. And he was a good baseball manager.
There's no doubt about that.
I highly recommend it if you can find that book, if it's still in print. It's a good read. So what does Atlanta have? The Falcons are iffy. How are the Braves doing? I haven't been able to find anything but Mets and Yankees games up here on TV.
Well, it depends on which team shows up. They just got through sweeping the Mariners in interleague play, and they're off. They come home this weekend, and they play, I think they play the Rockies this weekend, and then next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they play the Orioles. That's the last of their interleague games.
Do you all go watching Bobby?
I have, you know, about 3-4 years ago, my company bought season tickets, and they put me in charge of handing them out. People had to come to me and reserve them or ask for them for certain days or whatever. And for doing that, in exchange for that, they gave me 5 games that I could go to. And it was 4 tickets and a parking pass right across the street, very convenient, and, you know, any 5 games I wanted. So I'd go through and pick out 5 games. And I went to 1 game. Well, I take it back. I went to 2. And the other 3, I gave the tickets away. I just, I enjoy it, but I just, I don't know. As hot and humid as it is, it's just not very enjoyable. I'd rather stay here. Now, if they'd been playing football, I'd have showed up every game. But I just,
You still got all the Falcons home games?
I don't think I can name one player.
Yeah, I still got my season tickets for the Falcons.
I'm like you, Mike. I couldn't. Only player I know for Atlanta is the catcher,
McCann,
something like that, and Chipper Jones. That's all I know.
McCann. You ask how the Braves doing. McCann right now is on a tear. He was like 10 for 15 over the last 3 games. That ball almost looked like a beach ball coming up there to him.
I never did even hear who they named as manager after Bobby Cox retired.
Freddy Gonzalez. The guy used to be the third base coach for Cox.
Okay. I never was a Braves fan, so I don't know either.
Went to a lot of games when I was a kid. We lived, you know, I grew up right in town, and it was only about from my house to the stadium was about 1.5 miles.
Really?
When my uncle was, you know, when I was young, and I was very close to my uncle, and he was a big sports fan, and we would go to the game sometimes, and sometimes we'd walk home. And
Have you been to the new stadium, Bobby?
Yeah, I've been a couple, 3 times. It's nice.
You got to take your pocketbook with you, though, haven't you?
Well, I don't mind nothing. I mean, it's just like going to the Falcon games. I might buy a Coca-Cola, but that's it. But a 20-ounce Coke in a plastic bottle, like you buy in the 7-Eleven for $1.25, up there at the stadium, they're $4 a piece at the dome where the Falcons play.
You are kidding me.
So I'll, you know, I may buy one Coke just because I want something to drink, but other than that,
it's kind of snug, isn't it?
It's just, you know, and it, the old stadium, when the Falcons played at the Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, you could take a cooler in with you, or you could take food in with you. At the Dome, you can't. You can't take anything to eat or drink in there with you. So they kind of hold you hostage. If you want anything, you got to buy it.
Man, please. Is it a nightmare getting out of a football game?
I ride MARTA. I don't. It's not too much of a problem when you ride MARTA. If you were to park there, yeah, it'd be a nightmare.
But so I can kind of just. You just get off kind of right at the stadium, or?
Oh yeah, there's a station right at the Dome. You get off, and you're you walk up the you go out of the station, and it's a completely covered walkway over to the Dome. So if it's raining or whatever, you don't get wet, and you just go right in the gate into the Dome, and then when it's over, you come out and walk right back over and get back on the train. And I
so
park
how far
about
can you,
about two stations away from the Dome. It takes me maybe from the time the game's over, within 30 minutes, I'm back in my car, and I have no traffic when I get to the, you know, MARTA station.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Where do you go? You go on Sundays. You go to the Peachtree Station, or is there one?
No, I go to Inman Park. It's
okay.
From the church to the train station is about a mile. And then it's, like I say, it's, let's see, I make MLK, I make three stops between where I get on and the Dome. So a lot of times if I get out of church 12:15, 12:20, I still make a 1 o'clock kickoff.
No kidding.
And then our evening service at church starts at 5 o'clock, and most of the time I'm back at the church by 4:30, unless the game goes into overtime.
Well, you got to figure it out then, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
You just get MARTA to run to Jackson so you can ride
you
it in
that,
to work every day.
You got that right, brother. Listen, there's a train station 100 yards from the door of my building. If I could get them to run a track down here, I'd be on it every day.
How far down does it go, Bobby?
Goes to the airport on the south side. It ends at the airport. If you go north, there's two spurs going north. One ends at Shamley-Dorval. And the other one ends up on 400, just outside of 285 on 400. So that's
You would think they'd have one going south, wouldn't you?
You know, they've tried for years to get a rapid train system set up between here and Macon, and it never flies. Of course, even if they approved it today, I don't know that we'd see it completed in our lifetime because they'd have to buy right-of-ways and everything else.
Yeah, it's always too little, too late, isn't it?
Yeah, unless you were Buddy Fuller. I don't know if you ever heard the story. Did you hear the story about Buddy Fuller and I-75?
No.
No.
Somebody told Fuller, and this story came from Gunkel. Somebody told Buddy Fuller that they were going to run I-75 right through the middle of Locust Grove. So Fuller went down there and did some nosing around and found out where they were going to run it through at, and he bought some land, and he moved into a shack. Now, I heard the shack was just bare minimum, just four walls, outhouse, you know, just nothing. But he moved in there and lived there. He homesteaded it. And when they came through to do I-75, they say he made a truckload of money.
I'm sure he did.
Because he knew where it was going through. Somehow he found out where it was going through.
That's all it takes.
Yeah, you know. They tell me in his heyday, everything that man touched turned to gold.
I don't know.
Some guys are that fortunate.
Ooh. I could buy one right in the middle of it, and they'd decide to detour around me.
I'll build an overpass.
Yeah, I'd still be living under it. I'd be like a troll.
Yeah, I'd get frustrated and sell it, and then they'd strike gold on it. Or
there you go.
Oh. I'm going to go ahead and get our. We're going to be joined tonight by a true legend who's still going at it. He's about Bob Armstrong all the time and stuff. With Bill Dundee's working almost as often. I'm going to get him on the line with us and see what he's got good to tell us. So bear with me. We got a new switchboard here. Just as I was getting used to the other one, they changed everything up.
Hello,
Bill.
Sir.
Hey, it's Michael Norris, Bobby Simmons, and Jerry Oates. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium.
Okay, thank you very much.
The one and only superstar Bill Dundee.
Well, thank you. We on the air. We recording. What are we doing?
We're on the air. We're on the air live.
All right. Well, I'll behave then.
Bill, this is Jerry Oates. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Hell, I hadn't seen you in 25 years, I guess. Maybe more.
That's what I was talking to Mike about before we went on the air. I can't remember where I met you for the first time. Was it in Atlanta?
Atlanta, yeah, around Atlanta.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, around Ronnie West and all them. So somebody just sent me a thing.
I knew you were in trouble.
Yeah, I got you. Old Ronnie, he's all right. I love old Ronnie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think we could sit here and tell Ron West stories all night. Between all
yes, we could. If it was a real radio, it would put his black would be off the damn air. We couldn't have just after a couple, you know what I mean? Yeah. Somebody just sent me something on my email that says, Flair avoids jail by paying high spots. The Nature Boy Ric Flair will be avoiding spending time in jail after he finally came up with $35,000. I wonder who he bought it off. That's what it says. Somebody just said to me on my email thing.
Yeah, he was in hot water about that.
Yeah. He sold it. What?
I was asking Jerry if he loaned him any.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to hold his belt for him.
Yeah, I think that's what he did. He sold it to somebody and then sold it to somebody else. So somebody was holding it when I thought that you'd have it. I'm telling you, man.
That's hard to believe that he'd need some money, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he financed being the Nature Boy. You know how that goes. That was an expensive gimmick.
But wasn't it?
I'm telling you. Him and Big Dust, they would hire them lilies, man.
Well, you know,
outdo one another.
It's just like everybody else. You never think it'll end.
Well, when I go into this business, a guy told me when they thought, they all talk like this back then, hey, kid, save your money. It ain't how much you make, it's how much you save. And that's the kind of how it works. You can make $100 million, but if you spend $101 million, you're broke, right?
There you go.
Right, yep.
So, I mean, I'd always try to figure it the other way.
What did you,
as long as I got to the town, it didn't have to be a limo.
What year did you actually start wrestling, Bill?
1963.
In Australia?
In Australia. And then Jim Barnett came over about 64 and brought championship wrestling from Georgia, but it was actually, he just called it championship wrestling. So Mark Lewin, Ken Curtis, Red Bastien, Skull Murphy, Brute Bernard, Curtis Ayakawa, Big Bad John, all them boys. I knew all them before I ever got to America.
Did you work for him over there?
Barnett, yeah. It was pretty good gigs. Hal Morgan used to run all the league clubs over there, so there was a lot of good wrestlers in Australia, workers. I mean, not so much the American style. We was more like the English style. We did rounds in the clubs, and if the guy was down, you had to stand back and let him up, and so we actually wrestled. So when Barnett came over with the American style, the kicking and the punching and all, they just took off. So, of course, when you're local there, you do the favors for the guys. But we didn't care. $35 a pounds a week was what a guy made. If you like a bricklayer or a truck driver, if they made about 35 grand pounds a week, they were doing good. Hell, we was getting that per match. So if you got three matches a week, you was way ahead of the ball game.
Exactly.
You know, and they'd fly you to Brisbane, to Adelaide, and Perth, and all over Australia. So, yeah, we worked for him for 12 years.
So when Barnett wound up over there, is that when you made it over here to the States?
Kind of, yeah, kind of, no. Barnett sold his out to a guy named Tony Colone, and he hired Bobby Shane as the booker. And then Bobby came over and he took over for Colony, but Barnett had left. So all Barnett's crew left, Mark Lewin, Ken Curtis, and all them. So Bobby brought his own crew in. So he saw me and George, and he said, "You guys would get over good in Tennessee." He said, "I know the booker, Jerry Jarrett." So he said, "We'll call him right now." Because a lot of people had said that in the 12 years, but nothing ever really happened. So he says, no, I'm... He says, we'll go call him right now. So the time difference, we called him, talked to Jerry. They started with the paperwork, took a year, so the beginning of 74 to the end of 74, beginning of 75 before we ended up in America. But that's how we got here. Bobby Shane got us here.
Did anybody come with you?
George Barnes.
George Barnes.
Did we go over like son of a bitch in Memphis?
Really?
The first show we did in Memphis was Ron Fuller against Steve Kovac, and it was about $4,500. We shot the angle with me and the Australians, me and George Barnes against Tojo and Eddie Marlin, and the fifth week it was sold out. It stayed that way all summer. Then George got homesick, and he didn't particularly like it here, so he went back and I stayed to switch me baby face, and here we are.
Did you ever go back to Australia?
Yeah, I went back. Been back on vacation. When I came here, I came to stay.
Oh,
and then, you know, I made a home in Tennessee. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. A lot of people used to me, "Why did you leave?" But why would I leave? Hell, I was making money, did all right.
Now, did you work strictly for Jared, or did you work with Gulas any at all?
No, it was strictly, when we come here, it was Gulas Welsh. Jared was just the booker.
Right.
And then they got together, and then they fell out, and Jerry took Memphis, and Nick stayed in Birmingham, and the rest is history, as they say. But no, I worked for Nick. They were together a couple of years, or a year and a half or something, after I got here, so, yeah.
How would you compare the two as far as which did you prefer working with?
Well, see, we got booked by Jared. Even though Nick was the promoter, I mean, Bobby Shane said, "Look, when you get there, tell Jerry Jarrett you work for him." And so we actually came here really knowing who Jerry Jarrett was. We didn't know who Nick was, or Roy Welsh, or Christine Jarrett. We just knew, you know, and we had kind of swore an alliance to him. So I was on his end. I never worked on Nick's end much. Jerry kept us down there. He booked Memphis, and Nick booked Birmingham. I mean, Memphis, and Nick did the other end. So they had two ends of the territory. But I work for Jared mainly, so.
And you live in Memphis now?
No, I live in Jackson, Tennessee, but I lived in Nashville all the time. My family growing up, and I was working for the office I worked. We all lived in Nashville.
So Jackson's where compared to Nashville?
Jackson is 130 miles of Nashville heading west to Memphis. It's halfway between Memphis and Nashville. So if you on the way to Memphis, you go pass through Jackson.
Oh, I got you. I got you.
So you and George had teamed together in Australia before you came.
Yeah. We had, you know, yeah. We I mean, now, like I said, we were they used us in the middle of the card some, but we never got to beat none of the Americans. I mean, we did jobs for them, but they would put us over the local guys, and then you know. So yeah, we had our stuff together. We knew if we got here, and they gave us a little turn with a ball, we could run with it, and they did, and it worked, and here we are.
And then he came back briefly in, what, the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah. He came back just for a little vacation with his new wife, and he came back just to say hello. I talk to him on the Internet all the time, so he's retired. He builds hot rods and them three-wheeled motorcycles. He was always good at that, so that's what he does now. So.
For those that have never seen him, I've been lucky enough. I've seen video of George, and it's a shame that he didn't stay, because he would have been over like gangbusters, because he reminded me a lot of Lord Jonathan Boyd.
Yeah. A lot of we all grew up together. Boyd worked for Morgan, Luke Williams, Butch, me, Larry O'Day, Ron Miller. We all worked for the same guy in Australia. That's where we all started. I mean, we all knew one another. In fact, when Jonathan Boyd got here, and we brought him in here, he had a bald head and all that bullshit. If you saw me and him in Australia at the same time growing up, when we both started, he long dyed black hair and I did. We side boys. We looked a lot alike. He used to work as Pretty Boy Boyd, so. But then he changed to the sheep herder gimmick. But he had long hair. I mean, in the ring, if you just looked in the ring, you'd say, oh, it's done neon, oh, it's Boyd. That's so much we looked alike. But it all changed in the end, I guess.
So do you have anything to do with wrestling at all now?
Yeah, we still have. Me and Lawler's in Jonesboro, Arkansas, Saturday night. It's on the 7th for a car lot, so it's Saturday afternoon. They've got a show there for the weekend. So, we're there then. On the 30th of July, what, next month, Jackie Fargo, George Gulas, Jerry Lawler, and Bill Dundee, we're all in a oldies type, old school wrestling type show, so that should be quite interesting.
Where are you going to do that?
We're going to do that on July the 30th.
Where?
And it's in a building off of Trandy Lane. It's an old school gym. It's right off Trandy Lane, so I mean, people that live in Nashville know where it is. I worked in it once, so George got it, so he has the thing called old school Gulas wrestling, so he kind of does old school wrestling. So I think we'll do all right. Building hold about 700 people, maybe. So we'll see. I think we'll sell it out. We should. And then again, I think one another day, and have another show in Nashville sometime. When was that? There's another one, I think. At the fairgrounds, me and Dutch Mantel in a cage. My God, that will be exciting, right?
It should be.
Who do you work with more, Jerry or Dutch?
Lawler. Me and Lawler work more times than any other two guys in the face of the earth, I guess. I mean, it started in 1975, and it kept going up until Lawler went to Vince, so we had a 30-year run down here. I mean, if we had nothing else, nobody to work with, we just worked against one another, and it drew. So, but no, Lawler, we do it and we sleep against him. But we worked a lot against Dutch, too. So we was all heel, babyface, whatever. We switched it around, whatever we needed.
What's Mantel doing?
A couple more years. Gonna say a couple more years, and you and Jerry will be closing in on the Sheik and Bobo's record, or Darling Dagmar and Diamond Lil.
Yeah, I hear you. The Sheik and Bobo, yeah, they had a hell of a run too, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they first worked with each other in 1950, and I think the last time they worked with each other was in 1990. They worked
for and the Mets didn't change much from 1950 to 1990. At least we, when in the early 70s, we flip-flopped all over the place. I mean, them two never did a lot of big bumps to start with.
No, not at all.
What's Mantel doing now?
I think he just wrote a couple of books, and he promotes them. He has a wrestling school, and he like me, on the, if somebody books him and they have enough money, we'll go.
He's also announced he's running for president next year.
Do what now?
He's also announced he's running for president next year.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. Old Dutch, he wrote one book, now he wrote three. He has another one on the way, I think. I said, God damn, Mantell. Well, you were saying, now I read one, I said, man, you have a few things. He said, look, what's the name of my book? It says, The Wrestling According to Dutch. I can tell my story anyhow I like. I said, okay. So I started, well, I got one on the works. I guess everybody's going to write a book. There'll be a few people hide me, but that's all right. Because half of them don't, they only tell, they sugarcoat it. If you're going to tell the story, don't sugarcoat it. Just either it happened or it didn't happen.
There you go, right.
Amen,
there.
Amen, brother.
You know what I mean? So if you rob the fucking bank, you rob the bank. That's just how it is. I mean, I just drove the car. No, you robbed the bank too, so. And most of the books I have read are sugarcoated. Well, the pages I haven't read, the whole book, but Watchers was pretty, All right, but they all, everybody wants to be the baby face.
A lot of it depends on the, who's publishing it, too. I think everybody that's still under contract to McMahon, his ghostwriters go in and change history.
Yeah.
The wrestling was saved by the McMahon family, and it really didn't exist before then. And
yeah, well, it's the same when I told the guys doing mine. I said, now, if I tell you something or say something, because I really do the talking, then they do the writing. It's done the same way. But I said, if I use a word and cuss, you write it just the way I said it. He said, oh, yeah, I won't change nothing. I said, okay.
Did you work many other territories besides up there?
No, mainly here, but 2 years for Watts. I booked for him for 2 years from 84 and 85, the best 2 years he ever had. I took all the little guys down there, Ricky Robert Gibson, the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express, Buddy Landale, me, Dutch, Tony Falk, Tracy Smothers, who else did I take? All guys, just medium-sized guys, and Watts says, you ain't gonna bring all them midgets down here, are you? About a month later, he said, boy, that rock and roll is over like a son of a gun. I said, yes, they are. You don't have to be 6'10 and 300 pounds to be a wrestler. If people believe in you, they'll be a David and Goliath thing. So, and then I worked for Crockett, and I worked for Ted Turner. And I can't really say I enjoyed either one of them. I mean, I didn't like the corporate mold of professional wrestling. When I got to Ted Turner, it was corporate. Eric Bischoff was supposed to be running it. Dusty and Flair and all whoever else, and then Hogan came in. We're all supposed to be in booking committees or whatever else, and
I never really liked it. It just don't work like that. It doesn't work like that.
No. No, it do not, so. And then you have to be able to done something. I mean, being a referee in a hall in the ring, that's all very well, but what office, you don't learn a whole, and that's what Bischoff did. Then they brought him in because he wore a suit to give him the head honcho job over there for WCW. I mean, the people running it wasn't wrestling people.
Exactly.
But that's what they want in them corporate offices. So you just say, yes, sir, no, sir, kiss my ass, and do whatever they want you to do. That's, they like you. So anyway, yeah, 2 years I was there. Went around the world with him when we went to Ireland, Germany, all over London, England, and all that. That all sounds great, but it's no different. I'd rather be in Memphis every Monday night than that.
Yeah, I know what you mean, man.
That's one thing you can say about Memphis. They outlasted every other territory. They went nearly another 10 years after, everybody else was shutting down. What do you think, what do you contribute that to? Just the good booking, the loyal fans, or a combination?
The loyal fans too, but Lawler, he told everybody that they were, had a cartoon every Saturday morning. They said they're a cartoon, we're real, blah, blah, blah. And then when offered him a job, he went. If he had stayed, it wouldn't have been the sellout business we was doing, but him and I would have stayed. But when Lawler left and went to New York, the people just said, well, he lied to us for the last 30 years. He said he would never go. The reason he didn't go, they had never called him. And when they did, he went. And I went to Vince. I mean, I went to Turner, but I didn't make no bones about it. I mean, you know, I never went and told anybody I would never leave. So that's why that Memphis hung in longer, because he was there.
You think that was a mistake on their part, putting everything into Jerry Lawler instead of building up people behind him?
You mean
at one point you were as over as he was?
Yeah, I mean him and I. That's how they did it. But he had part of the territory. He was, you know, Jarrett and Lawler was, you know, they owned it, and you know, and he was over and he was hometown, and you know, he's. So, no, I think they did it right. I mean, they had him, and then they had me to get the people ready for him type thing, and I knew what my role was. But I was over. I didn't care. I mean, back in the day, from 75 till about 85, I'm not shitting you, but in Memphis, it was like being a rock star walking down the street. People hollering at you from cars, people stopping cars, and they'd come out and scream at you and holler and want, you know, just, it was unfreaking believable. And it was the only town I ever saw that in. And was, I don't know, they had Elvis there, and they had Jerry Lee Lewis, and they had Jerry Law, and they had Bill Dundee in that order. And that's about how it was. So I enjoyed the 10 years of that run, and then we slowed down a little bit, and I enjoyed the other 10 or 20.
Bill, this Bobby Cummings. We met at Ron's mama's funeral. I was one of the ministers there that day. We never crossed paths in the business, but were you in Memphis when they did the deal with Andy Kaufman?
Yeah.
What did you think about it?
Andy was that was a shoot with him and the women. I mean, we'd really thought it was a work, and he'd come in and he was vicious with them women, and he could actually wrestle a little bit. Somebody had showed him a couple of holds, so Andy actually took that serious. So then when they were just doing the one deal, when the Lawler went down there, it was supposed to be a one-shot deal, but Andy was so friggin' good at making interviews that the people hated him. So they run with it as long as it could go. Then they go on the Letterman show. Remember, he slapped him on the Letterman show and all that shit? Now, everybody in Hollywood, the first time they had the match, believed it. When Lawler dropped him on his head and he wore the brace, even Johnny Carson talked about that match on his Tonight Show.
Uh-huh.
And they said Andy Kaufman, blah, blah, blah. And then, on the fourth match, it was like, well, this is back to professional wrestling. And that's exactly what it was. But in Memphis, they bought it. They bought it. So, I mean, they drew a lot of money with that.
I was just wondering. I know Kaufman came to Atlanta. He showed up. Nobody knew he was coming, and he showed up one Sunday night there at the Omni at one of our shows. And all the guys in the dressing room, I mean, they wouldn't even let him in the dressing room. The guys here were just kind of, they wouldn't have nothing to do with him. And I was just curious what the reaction was up there. I've never heard anybody say.
The guy was an intelligent dude. I mean, they should have let him in. They should have done something with him. But who was booking Ollie?
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
Ollie or Watts, I mean, they weren't into gimmick things. I mean, when I come to help Ollie, me and Ronnie West, and I showed him the thing, and I wanted to bring Adrian Street in, Ollie didn't, I had to fight him and everything he did there. He was just one of them big, tough bastards that just believed in wrestling.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he didn't like Andy Kaufman. But there was money in Andy if you did it right. But Ollie wasn't that type of gimmick guy. He would just kick your ass, and that was what it was about.
Okay.
And you mentioned what you and Ronnie had done. I know I was going through some results, and I see a lot of stuff done on the east side of Tennessee in July of 83 that listed you as the promoter. Was that the time you were talking about?
Where was we at?
And not you were running, they were running shows. They were using the Georgia Championship Wrestling banner, but they were running shows in Knoxville and Chattanooga and using a mix of Jarrett guys and guys like Norman Frederick Charles, Carl Fergie, people like that.
That's it. That was it. He was the king. Ronnie West and I was running it. And we had the Fantastics.
Month.
Well, When it was just starting to take off, it was just, they pulled the plug on the thing. I don't really know what Ole's idea was of start. But we had a couple of guys that, you know, we got to look at them. When I went to Louisiana, we took them there too, so. But if Ole had left us alone, we would have got it going.
Did you ever do anything with Fuller over in Knoxville when he had Knoxville?
For Ron?
Yeah,
Ron, I worked for Ron. I worked for him in 75, too, when we come here. Me and Norvell Austin, it was a heel team up there. So way back when, and then we'd in and out for him, and yeah, I worked with Ron. I got along good with Ron. I liked Ron. And Jody Hamilton, when I the first went there, Jody Hamilton and Rock Hunter was the bookers. And they were the hot tag team. He was the man who worked, and Rock was the manager.
And I know you did a brief thing with Fuller and down in the Mobile Dolphin Inn. It actually did, I guess, bled over into Memphis as well. You had an angle with Stan Lane over the U.S. Junior title.
We kind of switched it back and forth just a little bit to make it seem more, you know, we was working in the U.S., you know what I mean?
Right. You wouldn't remember, but I actually wrestled you in Birmingham during that little brief run.
Okay. Was that for Nick?
No.
Who was running it then?
It was for Fuller. It was in the summer of 81. Yeah, it was during that little brief time. So I don't have to ask you who the worst person you ever worked with. I already know the answer. It was me because you worked with me.
But when you did, I mean, the guys that you work with when you've been around 50 years in this business is ungodly. You know what I mean? You just... People, if you work with me and then I never really see you again, type thing. It's not that you don't forget the guy, but then you're not in the business full time like I was. So I've wrestled another 500 guys, and you can't remember everybody.
No, you can't. That's a fact.
Yeah, you know, you they say, well, hell, I wrestled you one time. You know, I say, okay, well, I mean, I'm not being rude, brother, but I'm sorry. And you're talking to some kid in the dressing room because you don't really remember. But you've had 10,000 matches since then.
Well, when you were working for Watts, did you make all those horrendous trips as well? Or did you kind of home?
Not really. I was the booker. I worked in the office, and Watts would fly me up to Tulsa and fly me back and do all the things. But yeah, but the spot shows on. Yeah, we'd go to some of them, but no, I didn't make all them. Some of them had to drive from Louisiana to Tulsa and all that kind of stuff. No. But it was a long ass battery, the way we all lived in Alexandria, Louisiana. And we drove from there, like to Houston, Texas, on a Friday, and then we Monday to New Orleans, and, you know. So, yeah, there were a few long trips. The weekend was what was long, because you run Texas on one end, and Tulsa and Oak City on the Sunday. So you had, you know, it was a son of a bitch of a trip. But I flew, so. And so did some of the top guys, so that was all right.
Jerry can tell you about those horrendous trips out there.
Yes, I can.
Yeah, you worked for Watts, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
We were.
What years were you there?
I was there in 77.
No, you remember, okay, 77.
Murdoch. Carl Cox over there.
Murdoch and Rhodes and him, right? They were all... See, that was what... You know, that's the kind of guys that he used, the size of the guys that he used.
Right. John Tolis was there. We had a good crew.
On back up. To plug it back up.
But I didn't know you went out there later on and booked for him. I really didn't know that.
Yeah, in his book, in his shoot interview, he puts me over as, I guess, quote, the best booker he's ever had. I imagine he made more money than he ever had with me. See, the people would knock Tennessee or what we did in Memphis, but goddamn, any time we took it somewhere, it was on fire. But you still have to have the puppeteer dancing the puppets right. I mean, you know, it's
that's a
wrestling to cut. That's the, you know, you can see it happen in Memphis, but if you don't know what you're doing there and do it with it, then you just, it doesn't work the same. So you have to have the right puppeteer. And, you know, I knew all the angles, all the deals, everything we'd done for the last 20 years. I went to watch and took it down there, and we was on fire.
Did you work yourself out there?
Yeah. Me and Dutch worked against the Fantastics. Ricky and Robert had left, and they went over to Crockett, and then we stayed, and Buddy Landale was single heel, and me and Dutch tag team and the Fantastics was... And they were following Ricky Robert and Fulton and Bobby Fulton and that damn Tommy Rogers. They got over, and they were following Ricky and Robert, and them bastards was on fire, man, I'm telling you. So they worked hard, they got over. We had a hell of a run there, 2 years.
No kidding.
The Watts, he could holler and scream, but he didn't holler and scream at me, but I kind of had the understanding with him. He said, Willie, you holler and scream at me, you'll be next one will be long distance. I won't holler at you, you don't holler at me. If I do something wrong or you don't like, come talk to me. And that's kind of how we did it.
Did he kind of leave you alone?
Did he
leave you alone?
But when you're making God more money than he's ever made in his life, they're not going to bother you much.
That's true. That is true.
I mean, we was the first. I started for him on 84 on New Year's Day in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it snowed the night before I'd left Tennessee, and I drove down. So, and it snowed, and the snow was on the ground, but it was, so I thought, wow, this is, we're at the Barton Coliseum. Great big damn building, and there was $9,800 sitting there. I thought, what am I doing here? New Year's Eve, I had to leave my family. I never drove down because it was going to snow, so I drove most of the way down, stayed over in Brinkley, Arkansas on New Year's Eve, all by my lonesome. So anyway, got up, drove in there New Year's Day, $9,800 house. We had started playing the tapes next Wednesday after the Monday night in Little Rock with the Rock and Roll Express coming to town. And you know where you made it. Where was he making the TV when you was there? At the Boys Club?
Shreveport.
Yeah, the Boys Club, same place. And there was nobody in it. On the fourth week, you couldn't get a seat in that damn Boys Club. Women all over the place. Ricky and Robert were there live. The next Monday, we left there and we went back to the Burton Coliseum, and it was $42,000.
Oh, come on.
And it stayed that way for the next 2 years. It was unfreaking believable how them kids got over. We would go up to Tulsa, Oak City, on the Sunday afternoon. Would be $102,000, $103,000, $98,000, then go over to Tulsa that night, and it was a little building, a smaller building. It would be $34,000 or $40,000, or we'd be putting the ticket prices up, and stayed that way. I mean, Ricky and Robert were on fire. And the reason they got over, Ernie Ladd had Adler Heat on the heels, and he had Darso as a Russian, and Volkov, and they had whooped everybody. Well, the first night in that they came in live, that night when we brought them in, Watts says, what are you going to do with them? We'll beat them Russians. He said, for the belts? I said, yep. Ernie has your heels so hot, but you have no baby face to work with them. So anyway, he said, you're the booker. Well, he fired me the next day if it don't work. But he didn't. I said, the next 2 years. Man, they had a hell of a run down there.
I had no idea that kind of money was being drawn, like in Little Rock.
I'm telling you, brother, you run it once a month. This Burton Coliseum, it was unreal.
How'd y'all do it?
Unreal.
How'd you do in Shreveport?
We'd sell it out a little bit. The Shreveport wasn't the biggest building in the world. It was that little Coliseum there. You worked. We did good. Every building there we worked in was sold out.
How about
most of the time. Now you would do a little something wrong in the angle and it would drop off, but it was just a little. But most of the time they were full.
New Orleans and Baton Rouge too?
Same thing. I think he grossed. I made a bad deal. I went on a money thing with no percentage deal and no nothing. I mean, he paid me every dime he said that he would, and we agreed on all the kinds of shit. But in the 2 years that were run, he did a little over $22 million.
Man.
In the 80s. That was a lot of money from what they were used to drawing down there.
Oh, please.
I have every book wrote down what the everything was. I wrote, you know, everything down on the pages, this is my booking page, and have the houses. It was ungodly.
So you outdid Robley.
Yeah. And the other one, what's his name? Mantell, Ken Mantell. And Ernie Ladd, and Bill Watts, and Dusty Rhodes, and Dickie Murdoch when they were all helping. We had the best 2 year run that ferry ever, ever had.
That was all probably brand new to those fans because the Mid-South and even going back as far as McGirt, that territory was all known as blood and guts.
But it was big guys' blood and guts. I mean, you know, it was just...
Right, exactly.
It was... Ricky Morton could sell, man. Them people had never seen nobody sell Ricky Morton. I mean, you know, he just unbelievable. They felt sorry for him, and he would sell. And then when he tagged Robert, whatever the finish was, we'd go wham, and they would go crazy.
That was probably only all guys since Hodge got out of fans in that territory. But you're right, those 2 years that you were booking down there are well documented in the hottest the territory ever had.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just, and it wasn't all Bill Dundee's brilliance, it was just that I knew what worked in Tennessee, and I had the players and put in the position, and I moved them on the board. You know what I mean? Playing chess, it's
right.
all the things sit there until you move them. That's what wrestling was about then. They had never seen it, so I just had the players and put them in the right spot. And Magnum TA was starting there, and I only had him not dead, but he didn't have a baby face over. He just kept putting the heels over, which was great for me when I got there because they were all on fire, but no babyface. And JYD, he needed a rest, so we beat him in the Loser Leaves Town. We're wrestling too. And I said, Bill, I go get this big dog out of the yard because the little dog won't get over. They keep yelling for JYD, but he doesn't really mean, you know, he's been there, what, 12 years?
He was there
so
a long
time. So he said,
time.
Do what? Yeah, a long time. He said, do whatever you want. So I talked to JY. I said, hey, man, we'll do this, blah, blah, blah. We come back at Stagger Lee, and then him and Watts do money against the Midnight Express, the Stagger Lee and Cowboy Bill Watts. But we had to give him a little rest, and then we brought him back.
Which version of the Midnight Express was there? Was that Condrey and Eaton or Lane and Eaton?
Yeah, Condrey and Eaton. And Jimmy Cornette was the manager. He was just a fresh-faced kid, just starting. Went from taking pictures at the Louisville Gardens to being the manager.
You tell some horror stories about some of the heat they threw down there.
Ooh, the first time he ever got punched in the nose, it was funny, man. This big cowboy reeled over the wall and nailed Jimmy. Ah, damn, the fight was on. Dennis Condrey and Eaton and Watts, Grizz, me, were trying to get him out of there. Oh, hell. Anyway, they had to fight a lot there. And I'll tell you, one of the worst times, too, was bad there was... The one on the beach, what the hell was it? Biloxi. Yeah,
Biloxi,
me and Dutch had a couple of fights, and Barry Dasso hit a guy with a coal miner's glove there one night. And, oh, Jesus. Biloxi would get a little wild.
That Oak City was brutal.
Yeah, them big cowboys up there.
You're not kidding.
But Tulsa was bad. When we would go, they had two places in Tulsa. There was one at the fairgrounds, I think, and then one at the Tulsa Coliseum. One of them was a little smaller than the other, the smallest of the building. It was, whew, it was rough. And the cowboys was rough.
Yeah, they were real rough.
Yeah. And so, but, it was fun. I mean, all them things, when you're actually in the fight or having to fight, the kids today have no clue how to fight to the ring there and back or what's happening or somebody jumps on you. That just don't happen no more.
They don't know
what
heat
you
is,
had,
man.
No, they don't know what heat is. So if you were, you know, and when you're over as a baby face, and when they don't like you, they don't like you, and that's just how it works.
Me and Jerry has talked about this many times on the show. the things they do today, walking out through the crowd and doing those things, back in the 70s and the early 80s, if you had done that, you'd have come back cut.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you just couldn't do that.
You know, I mean, the butcher would do it occasionally. I mean, I've seen him do it here and there, but, I mean, the people are kind of scared of Abdullah, and he would be going 100 miles an hour, and, you know, well, they didn't stop. I mean, I've seen Brody do it, a couple of guys, but not too many guys. Went, and why would you go out in the crowd? I mean, back then, they didn't like you.
Yep.
And as Bill Watts used to say, you're not fighting the people. You're fighting one another, so you don't need to go into the people. Get all the heat in the ring. And if they really don't like you, they will come in the ring to get you.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So they don't have to go out and piss them off in the crowd.
That was always my theory, man.
That's it. I mean, we had a guy... Me and Rocky Johnson was working against David Schultz and Nature Boy Roger Kirby in Louisville, Kentucky. That's when Dr. D just started. So this kid, we were walking down, and they had the belts, and we had big brass belts back then. This was about 77, maybe 78, early 70s, whatever, middle 70s. But anyway, so me and Rocky's walking down to get in the ring. So this kid jumps, kind of comes through under the rope, and he says, Dundee, let me in there. He says, I'll kill that Dr. D. I don't like him. I said, well, go ahead. So I stepped out of the way, and he walked up the step, and he bent over to put his head through the ring and walk into that ring. That damn Schultz hit him with that belt. I swear to God, gentlemen, his head just peeled over like somebody split a pineapple in half. One fell one part, and one fell the other part. His blood, I said, oh, God, he's killed him. Anyway, here comes the police, just got him out, took him all the way to the back, took him to the hospital. We never heard one more word out of that. But, brother, if you did that today...
No, please.
Yeah, you'd be owning every, you know, whatever it was in the wrestling business, you'd own it in the territory they did it in, because it's just Sioux City.
You guys ever notice that when the marchers used to get into the ring and decide to fight somebody, they'd always pick the worst person they could think of?
Yeah, and then they never really knew what to do when they got there. It wasn't like, you know, Mike Tyson jumped in. It was like this kid may get, you know, whoever gets, well, I'll kick your ass and they jump in or whatever the thought is. But once they got in there, it was like, what do we do next? You know, you didn't have to really beat him up. You could just swoosh him around and throw him out, and the cops would have got him. But, you know, some of the guys would like to fan the piss out of them. But anyway... Yeah, it's all a different thing. We did a gimmick matches in Memphis one night. Lawler rode a horse. Fabs went to the ring in a limousine, and I rode the motorcycle. Knocked the lady down. The damn turned the lights out, and the damn touched the front brake. Couldn't see. They put the spotlight in my... Well, it was a terrible disaster at the end of the thing coming down on the motorcycle. Yeah, I said I was going too fast, but that wasn't it. But anyway, it might have been a little bit. Anyway, so... The handlebar bumped this lady on the thigh. So they took her to the back. If that had happened today, all she wanted was a picture.
Oh, really?
I signed it. Lawler signed it. The Fab signed it. Jackie Fargo signed it. The guy thing, everybody gave her a picture. I mean, she had a Charlie horse on her leg. It would never broke her leg or nothing, but, I mean, a Charlie horse today will get you $500,000. With a motorcycle and a wrestling ring, you know what I mean?
Well, let's go back a little bit. You mentioned somebody earlier that you work with in Australia that I know that you work with quite a bit in Memphis too. That was a legendary character, and that was Big Bad John. So I know you've got some stories to tell about him.
Oh, he I'm telling you, man, he was a character. I mean, did y'all know him, John? Big John.
Yes, I did.
My God. He was a heel one, you know, all the time. He's running Australia, and then he was heel here. Then in 1976, they switched him babyface as the Bicentennial Baby, and they teamed me and him up in Memphis. And that was really my first. I knew him all them years in Australia, but we never really hung around a lot. But then we drove together. This is how John started his day. This is a true story. We'd stay over, and then he would say, I'll go get breakfast ready. He always was laughing and joking and carrying on. I said, well, okay. I didn't know what he was doing. Hell, this is 1976. Just got here. Been here a year.
So anyway, he had a little half pint of vodka. He had an orange, and he rolled himself a doobie, and he laid it on the nightstand. And every morning, he'd wake up, he'd take the top off the little half pint thing, he'd cut his orange in half, he'd pick up his doobie, light it, then he'd hit the damn thing, squish the orange, and he'd do, because he had two gulps, he would do the thing, the bottle would be empty, and two swallows, two the orange, two, then he'd sit there and enjoy his doobie every morning. Then I went, wow. How the hell do you function? And that was just breakfast. The rest of the day could be anything. And by the time we got to town at night, whoo, mercy, he was feeling no pain. But I liked John. He was a good guy. He was very good to me. He was good to me in Australia when he didn't really have to be. I mean, we were just doing jobs for everybody, but, you know, I got along good with him. And then that tragedy that happened over there in L.A., I don't know what that was about, but somebody stabbed him, didn't they?
That's what I heard.
That's what the story's always been, that they found him stabbed to death.
Yeah, they found him in the bathtub. His wife was Australian, and she called over to talk to this office. I think she talked to Lawler and said that they had killed him. They, I don't know who they were, because nobody's ever said no names to me, but
I
just
never
said
heard
they.
I
don't know if it was a drug deal went wrong, if it was this or that, and I don't know, but it was. But I know he got murdered.
You know, people always talk about people who could talk people into the seats, and Dusty's name always comes up, and Wonderful Patterson and all that. But to me, Big Bad John ranked up right up there with them. It's one of the
Dusty did it mainly better as a babyface, but I mean, as a heel, there was nobody better than him. He was, as a heel, he'd talk. And then when we switched him, baby, he'd just talk forever. So we had a run, me and him, against Lawler and Big Plowboy Fraser. Remember Fraser?
Yep.
They brought him in because they brought him in to be Lawler's partner just because me and John and the size of the thing. So it grew. I'd do all the selling and then tag John, whatever we did for the finale, then we'd go. But I enjoyed him. That's how he started every day.
You mentioned Fraser. Did you ever buy a watch from him?
I bought a watch from him, and me and Jerry Jarrett bought two guns from him. He bought a gun, I bought a gun. And I'll be damned, the FBI came and took him off us because Dan had sold him for not having a license. And the guy asked us, he said, did y'all go get them in Tennessee? And I said, yeah, he brought them to the Coliseum, we're telling you. We just bought them off him, and he's always selling shit, watches, things, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they took the gun, they kept it about 3 months, they brought it back, gave it back to us. I don't know if they were trying to bust Stan for selling them without a license or what they were trying to do, but they never did nothing to Jared and me. We just brought the guns back and gave them back and said, thank you very much, sign here. An old phrase. He was always selling something. Want some shoes, neighbor? That's what he would say.
That's one thing about the business. Go ahead,
Jerry.
I was just going to say, there's one thing about the business that produced characters.
Yeah, and that's what's wrong. There's none today. I mean, everybody looks alike on Vince's show. Everybody works alike on Vince's show. Most of the young guys, I know you have The Undertaker, and you have Shawn, and you have The Rock if he comes back, or Stone Cold. They are individual characters, but most of the young guys all look alike. And what the difference with us was, we at least all did the same thing, but we did it different, and we looked different doing it.
Well, that's the thing. The last time I turned it on, it looked like that they just turned a bunch of guys that come out of a school loose. You know, everybody looked the same. It was, you know, I don't know. There's nothing. There's no oddity to it, you know, that makes.
No, there's no. And I understand the world has changed, and I understand Hollywood has changed, and I understand everything has basically changed. Not just wrestling,
But if MMA fighting took off because they did what they thought we was doing that was real. And we made it look, now it's just a show for television.
That's all.
Back in the day, in the 70s and 60s and the 50s and whatever, there was room for doubt. There's no room for doubt now.
No.
Vince tells you what it is, how he wants it to be, and all that bullshit that he does, that's just how it is. But when we was doing it, there was room for doubt. I mean, if you had a hot angle, then people would say, I'm going tonight because they're mad at one another.
That's exactly right. And that's how it worked. The guy on the front row, he'd tell you, well, I know it's all crap.
Yeah,
I was there,
but I'm here.
That Dundee and Lawler really got mad at each other.
That's it.
I mean, they
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. There was everyone was, you know, so, but that was the difference of how they worked and we worked. And today it's a show, and it's a shame what this turned out of business.
Is he still drawing serious money, or the town's papered, or what?
I think a lot of it's paper, but I'm sure he still does serious money. I don't think he's doing like he was in the heyday everybody else. I mean, his run's over. He doesn't have no stars. Jerry, I mean, he brought back The Rock. He brought back Austin. He brought Triple H back. I mean, he has no real stars. I mean, Cena's made a couple of movies, and he's the main event, and he's done the pay-per-views, and he's not a bad-looking guy, but he's not over.
No, that's like you said. He had to bring them back. I mean, those guys are gone. I mean...
Yeah, they're like us. The day's over. I mean, you know. I mean, and when me and Lawler worked, we drew 2,000 people in Nashville about 2 months ago. And that show for Marcus, thing, he used to work for TNA, and there was 2,000 people showed up. They showed up to see Memories and what Lawler Dundee, what it meant to them in the good old days. And you know, you get away with that every now and again, and it's just. In fact, I sent a YouTube thing to George of the match me and Lawler did. So the George Barnes in Australia. So he emails me back and he says, "Well, Bill, I got your match and I kind of enjoyed it." He said, "But I'd like to see a few more bumps and a few more things happen." I said, "Yeah, you and the people that bought a ticket, they would all like to shoot or thing, but that's what they got." He was funny, man. I said, "Yeah, and so would the people that bought a ticket."
I know the last time I worked, you know, I was like you. You would have probably liked to have done it for him too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you, and the last thing to go on is your mind, really, because you really think you can do this shit like you did back 20 years ago, but you can't.
In your mind and in your heart, I know the last time I went to wrestle, my wife said, "I don't want you to get hurt." I said, "I can still do this." And I got there, and you know what it was too? I might could have, but I just didn't want to get hurt anymore. You know,
that's it. You just but your mind. That's how exactly how you think. I climbed up onto the turnbuckle one time. We was meeting, I think it was a Lawler, and I slammed his ass like I'd done 100 times, and I was going to do that ass jump across his chest where you put one foot in either side of him and you sit on his chest.
Right.
And I got up onto the turnbuckle, and he's laying there, and I looked down and I thought, "What am I doing?" And I climbed down. I don't know what the people thought. I climbed there and just walked over and dropped the elbow on
him. Just so you got a nosebleed up there.
Yeah, I thought, what am I doing? I've got a fucked up knee, and I'm going to jump on this. This is absolutely crazy, but that we had done that spot so many times, and when I got up there, I looked down. I said, "Oof, thank you very much."
The last time I refereed, I went for Ben Masters down in Cordell, Georgia. He talked me into refereeing a match with two guys I didn't know, and as young kids, and neither one of them knew what they were doing. And somehow I wound up out on the ground, and this one kid grabbed me by the hair and ran me toward a stack of toolboxes. And my mind told me I could go over those toolboxes. However, the rest of me didn't agree that I could go over those toolboxes, and I wound up pulling them over on top of me, and I was laying on the ground. And that was when I thought, what am I doing?
That's it.
And that was when I retired. I said, it's over.
Yeah. I mean, they call me on, and I've got about 9 matches in the next month, 2 months coming up, and they'll call and say, "Well, who am I working with?" That's the first thing. Never mind the money. Tell me who I'm working with, and then we'll get to the money. So if they don't say somebody I know, well, thanks, but no thanks.
Because
you never know today, brother.
You don't know, man. You know, they want to go out there and try to impress you. You've seen it all.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You don't have to impress me, brother. And I promise you, I'm not leaving the ring, so you don't have to be snatching my fucking hair or doing this or doing that. I'll be right there. Anytime you want hold of me, just reach out.
Oh, yeah, them young. But we was the same when we was young.
I guess so.
You know, when Lewin and all them came over to Marcin and Red Bastien and I mean George, we were two dumb kids. We'd attack them and think we were doing great. Kick our ass, you know what I mean? But that's just, and then you learn as you, you know. This is more of a knot than it is a physical confrontation.
But the thing about it is today, I mean, we all had decent training anyhow. You know,
right.
We had, these guys learn in the backyard.
Yeah, or somebody that don't know nothing teaches them for $100. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You're right. All we learned to kind of shoot a little bit. I mean, we learned to wrestle, you know, and we could do enough to beat most marks. We may not have been able to beat Dr. Death Steve Williams in his heyday, but we did enough to hold our own. But they don't even learn that today.
No, they don't know. They don't know a hammerlock from a padlock.
No, and it's just, and it's sad. I mean, and they call themselves wrestlers, and half of them don't want to go to the gym. They don't want to lift weights. They just...
They don't have.
They're either big or fat, or little and skinny. Nothing. And if they have gear, it looks just like the gut. Yeah.
Tennis shoes and cut off jeans and t-shirts.
And everybody in the card's got a belt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. You know, it's just the thing. You used to take pride in somebody saying, what you do, I'm a wrestler. You know, now if some half of them kids said, I'm a wrestler, the guy would laugh at them.
Thank you.
You know, that's the main thing. Most of us got in it because we wanted in it, not because somebody said, hey, man, you want to be a wrestler? You got a big body or this or that, or my dad's a promoter, I'll get you a job or some shit. We all persevered till we got in. And it was hard back then.
It was hard to get in.
Right. Somebody wants,
I mean, if they let 30 guys a year in, that was a lot.
Yep. That's about right.
Now you go a whole cars where you don't know nobody. Not so. I mean, I've been in this business 50 years, gentlemen, and I have went into buildings, and they have looked at me like I'm fucking off the arc, which I probably am to them, but... I'm thinking, I don't know a soul here, and I'm maybe some of those daddies that all be around their mama hanging around forever. You know what I mean? It's just, that's how they are, the little bit. I said, oh my God, they're kids. You know, it's just, hell.
Just don't get hurt, that's the main thing.
No, that's why I work with a lot of them. But hell, I watched him the other day, I was telling us what he was building for the... them, whoever it was, the misery, and he drop kicked him. I thought, what the hell? So me and him, when we did that 2,000 people in Nashville, and I knew, I said, you're not going to fucking drop kick me, are you? He went, yeah. Wow, okay. I was thinking, why are we doing this? Really, I mean, we didn't need it.
Didn't
need it. And what's he, 60?
Oh, yeah.
If you land wrong at 60, brother, and something pops, you're done. You know how that goes.
Oh, God.
Every
week we do a Jerry Oates Natural Products Name of the Week. Jerry is our sponsor for this. And basically what I do is I bring up a name from, wasn't really a big star, but a lot of people have forgotten about that deserves to be remembered. And I pick one this week, and I know you work with a lot. I know that Bobby and Jerry are know of him. That's Frank Morrell.
Oh, please.
The angel. There's another funny bastard.
Yes, he is.
I tell you a funny story about old Frank. When Randy Hales took over, y'all know who Randy is? He was the one that did Power Pro after Memphis went away. He kind of worked for Jarrett and Lawler, then he started his own company called Power Pro Wrestling. And we made it in Memphis, and we still run Louisville and Evansville and all the same town. So Frank was the referee.
So there's a long ass from the building. You could run right at the back of the bleachers. You could run from one end of the building to the other, and you'd come to an exit door. So we all went around the front to get a coffee, so Enzo was standing at the front. So Frank says to Randy Hills, now Randy's 6 foot two or three and long, skinny legs, and Frank was 6 foot and 250. I'm starting to put a little weight on because he quit wrestling. So anyway, he says, Randy, I'll race you to the back of the building. So Randy says, okay, and he takes off. The room, he's saying, Frank running like a son of a gun behind him, man. I mean, they are hauling ass. So we were kind of jogged on behind. Well, when Frank got about 8 feet from the end of the wall to stop, he's going so fast he's overbalanced. And the poor bastard fell forward, put his hand against the wall, it snapped his wrist back, broke his wrist, and then he banged his head on the, when he fell down, he banged his head on the wall, and then his knee hit the ground. So in that goofy race, just horsing around before the show, he broke his wrist, put a big dent in his head, and banged his knee all up. Frank, why are you running like this? And I mean, this is when he's still laying there. We've called the ambulance. We're trying to make it funny, but it really isn't funny. I said, what was you racing for? He said, well, I thought I could beat him. I said, that's it? There was no money? There's no nothing? You just wanted to beat him? I said, if you'd asked him, he would have put you over. I said, we've been doing that for 100 years. And he kind of laughed at that, but God damn, it was funny. But he broke his wrist and his head and his knee, all in just a race at the end of the building.
Well, we're Frank now.
I saw him last October at that Legends thing that he did, and I did it again this end of September and the 1st of October, again up there in Gallatin at Scott Teal's house. He was there. His knees are all kind of banged up. They had to help him up and down the stairs, but he's still living up in East Tennessee.
Yeah, he's been to Mobile the last couple of years for the reunion.
Yeah, he goes to that, and the thing is, this is the first. Me and Ronnie West went to the one last year in Scott Teal's house, and I'd never used it. They sent me an invitation, but I'd never really go, but we'd been on the circus for the last 4 years, so we didn't. But I'm home now. Like I said, I'm writing my book, and I work for a friend of mine, Bart Mann's Record Service, so I'm kind of helping him try to get off the ground. It went belly up, but we've got it going again, so. So, I mean, I'm going to go to it again, but I don't usually go to them. And the main reason, this is, and it may just be an ego thing for me, I just don't really know. I just don't want to talk about the past. You know, I mean, I know that's what we're doing, and we all were in this business for 100 years, but I keep thinking, well, there's tomorrows, and there we go again with the mind thing, thinking, well, I'm not old like them fuckers, but I am. And I really enjoyed it when I went last year, and I'm going to go back this year. And I'd never went, and it was that little ego boost thing of myself saying, well, they may be old. I'm not old yet. You know, you talk yourself into being the youngest of the bunch. So, but I did go, and I did have a lot, and I had a good time, and I'm going to go again this year. So I may go to Mobile. I've been asked to go a couple of times and never went, but I did enjoy myself.
Mobile.
You'll
well,
have
I
a
got
ball
a caller
if you
on the line. Yeah, Mobile's a great time. I got a caller on the line. I want to get on Bill with you real quick. Let me get him on the line real quick.
Okay.
It's a caller from area code 804. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, this is Dick Steinborn.
Hey, Mr. Steinborn.
Dickie Steinborn.
Good to hear from you, Bill.
Good to hear from you. How the hell are you?
Good. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Dickie. How are you?
Pretty good. Listen, I live in Richmond, Virginia, and I live in an area called the FAN, F-A-N. It was put together by Thomas Jefferson. It's got all European-type homes and so forth. And right in the middle of the FAN, which, like this, you would fan yourself, is what they call Monument Avenue. And every two or three blocks, they got a two-story tall statue of a guy on a horse. It's Robert E. Lee. It's really Confederate and so forth. So they have a newspaper in this town that's called The Style. They give it out free. They print about 50,000 of them. They came into my gym and put me on the cover. I couldn't believe it. I said, what are you doing that for? I said, well, you're a retired wrestler and you're 77 years of age. So if you guys want to pick it up, you go into the internet, go Style Weekly, STYLEWEEKLEY.com. One more time. Style Weekly, one word, com. Dot. So.
No, but you don't want to.
Anyway, look, you could check that out.
Well, we will.
Can I, Billy, let me tell you one story about Jerry Oates. Jerry, would you mind me telling the story of your first night you wrestled in Columbus, Georgia?
No, go ahead.
Would it matter if he did care?
No.
No, I didn't think so. So yeah.
Right.
This is a funny story. It's a double cross of the referee. Fred Ward was the promoter. He had two daughters, and they married two gentlemen. One of them was Ralph Freed. He worked in the office. The other one was Leon Ogle. He was his referee. And Leo never wrestled. Should never have been a referee. And thought he had power because his father-in-law was Fred Ward. So Jerry gets ready to break into the business. He's going to have his first match in Columbus, Georgia. And Fred always, when he starts somebody out like Jerry, he gives him a 15-minute match, and then the next week it's a 20-minute match, a return match, because it's a Broadway. So I've trained Jerry, and I tell him, I said, Jerry, whatever you do, I says, the last 2 minutes in this draw match, I says, you got to make a comeback, and you got to fly like nobody's biz, and blah, blah. And I got this Jody and I, Hamilton, and I told him, I said, would you mind the last 2 minutes, let Jerry shine and so forth? Oh, great, and boom. Well, and then I told Jerry what to do. Now, the bell rings. It's a draw. And the assassin rolled out of the ring, and he backed out of the ring, and he staggered back toward the dressing room, walking backwards. And Jerry did exactly what I told him to do. He jumped up on that second turnbuckle and leaned out, put his hand on the left on the post, and reached out with his five fingers and pointed at the assassin, and went back with his finger to his watch, and back, and give me five more minutes, five more, and everybody, yeah, five more. Well, what do you think happens? Leon pulls Jerry down from the corner and starts counting. Hey, two, three, and he gets up to 50. Here comes the assassin. He comes back and, what's going on? It's a 15-minute match. What right did this referee have to give him five more minutes? And all, so he comes back in the ring. Well, Jerry blown up. It stunk for the next 5 minutes. Horrible. I go in the dressing room, and I swear, when Leon walked through that door, I said, Leon, let me ask you something. What right do you have to give somebody five more minutes? Well, I'm just going to show these guys you can't be putting the heat on me. I said, but your father's the one that signs the your father signs the contract. You're just an official. You're supposed to do what you're supposed to do. Well, I'll teach you all a lesson. Well, sure enough, they brought the match back to next week. It then went through the same thing. I told Jody what to do, and I told Jerry what to do. Sure enough, Jerry jumped up on that second turnbuckle. Give me that 5 minutes again, and the crowd went with it again. And Jerry jumped down, and Liam took the heat away, took the glory away. He pushed Jerry back, and he started counting over that top rope, and he's counting at the assassin, and the assassin's backing up to that door. And Jerry leaves the ring. And just about the time Liam says 20, the assassin dumps into the dressing room, and he turns around, and there's nobody in the ring. I said,
wow.
He learned his lesson.
Yeah. Dickie likes to rib. I mean, you all know, if you know Dickie Starnborn, you know he likes to rib people and do things. I don't remember this, Dickie, but remember when I lost my hair to Jerry Lawler. I shaved it all off in the ring. So the next week, I go start growing it back, and I was going to start doing the Elvis gimmick, where I had the suit and the cape and the whole thing and the scarf and all that shit. So the lady had made it and brought it to this little town. So Dickie's in the dressing room, and he says, what's that in there? I said, this gimmick I'm going to start doing. He says, you need to wear it tonight. I said, this won't fucking go with no hair. I said, this is the Elvis thing. I mean, and he says, no, this is fucking great. He's really, and oh, he goes. So he said, no, you need to wear it tonight, Bill. I said, it doesn't go with no hair. And he said, no, I promise you, don't go crazy. So anyway, I put the suit on, the cape, the pants, the jacket, the scarf, the glasses, and I walk out that dressing room floor, and I swear to God, nobody said nothing. And I turn back and look at the door, and Dickie is fucking rolling on the ground. Anyway, I wore the suit, and he tells me it's great, this is great, and it wasn't pissed, but 10 months later when I had a head full of hair. But anyway, that night he got me a going a bald head and a freaking Elvis suit. Nothing go, boys, I promise you. Remember that? He was rolling on that pole. He was wrestling. You was working as Mr. Wrestling. You had the mask on. I thought, fucking look at that. That was funny.
It was funny to Dickie, not you, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying, but I mean, they never said nothing. I don't really know if they knew it was me or what. But who the hell is it, isn't it? Elvis suit with no hair. But anyway, he talked me into doing it. So I could imagine he could talk you into that match or whatever else you wanted done.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Shoot. How long have you been in Virginia?
23 years.
All right. Handsome Jimmy lives up that way. He's in Charlottesville.
Yeah. I've talked to him a few times.
Yeah, he's joined up there. So, yeah, we used to play the circus up through there. We used to play Virginia. Well, you just go by, I mean, are you just a weightlifting gym? Are you still teaching people to wrestle, or what are you doing?
What I did was I rented this house with option to buy. I mean, finally, my dad passed away, left me some money, and I bought the house. Well, I moved the people out upstairs. I moved upstairs. Downstairs, I converted the whole downstairs, tore up the floors, and I jacked up the beams and put bricks underneath them, so I knew I was going to have some weight in there. So I have three large rooms, and then I put mirrors up about 8 feet, 10 feet ceilings. And on top of that, I got beautiful framed pictures of all the guys, the pictures I took pictures with, and so forth, and all my career. And I was an amateur photographer all my life, and taking pictures.
Yes, she was. I remember that too.
All the time taking pictures, and still got all those negatives. You know, when I was wrestling in New York, I went to, they invited me to come see Stanley Weston, who ran Wrestling Review magazine. And he did a big story, my first fight. And he said, Dick, he says, well, would you do me a favor? I said, what? He said, I can't get in the dressing rooms. Can you shoot pictures in the dressing rooms? I said, sure. So when I was in California, I shot pictures in the dressing room. Stevens, you know, the doctor checking his blood, and just nice black and white with a beautiful camera. And then the rest, then I got bored. I went down to the ringside and shot underneath the rope and shot Stevens coming off the, Gomez coming off the top rope onto Stevens. And this Phillips, he paid me $125 for one 35-picture roll, black and white, 400 black and white, 400 ASA, and it came out beautiful pictures. But all, and I developed them. I had a dark room at my dad's Orlando promotion. I used to promote the little program I put out, and I always put different pictures in there, different negatives. I got so many negatives. I got boxes and boxes and boxes of pictures. Nothing but a pictorial history of different things, different guys, and Johnny Walker when he was wrestling without the mask on, back in our youth. And one thing that I used, in all my 33 years, there has only been 7 times when I have been approached by a fan who gave me a scrapbook to autograph. Well, what do you think's in that scrapbook? She's got the page before, the week before you were there, there's the card, and she's got circled who won, who draw, and you look in there and you can read the card, and you know how, if they drew anything, because you're standing there tonight looking at the house, and then you turn it back 2 pages, and then you see who was in the territory, who lost, and there's this ticket stub she's got. There's the pictures that she shot with Ricky Romero with his arm around the girl, and you go back page and back, and you can cover 3 months in that one little scrapbook, and you know why they're drawing money, or you know why they're not drawing money. And 7 times it's happened to me. And Ric Flair came up to me when he was 16 or 17 years of age in St. Paul, Minnesota, and handed me that scrapbook. And I signed it. And he became champion, and I ran into him in Puerto Rico for the first time, and he came up to me, and I shook his hand. I said, it's a pleasure meeting you. He said, I met you back in St. Paul, Minnesota. I said, no, you didn't. He said, yeah. He said, I gave you my scrapbook. I said, I remember you. You don't remember, you don't forget people like that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, what are you going to do with them all? Are you going to turn them into dollars, or are you just going to keep them the way they are? I mean, people buy that shit all the time.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. What did you say?
I said, are you going to just keep them for your personal use, or are you going to try to market them or do them, I mean?
Well, let me explain this. I ran my gym for 23 years, and I'm down to three students. And one guy's a doctor. He's been here 19 years. I can't get rid of him. He comes three times a week. He likes to, he's the head of anesthesiology at the Veterans Hospital, and he releases this pressure. You know, Jerry knows that he ran the gym. They come in a couple of sets of bench presses and some little stretches and so forth, and you see this big, and well, now you're training him like a wrestler. Now, how would I train this guy? And then I show him how to do it, and that way I get a little workout at the same time. In the meantime, I lived here in Richmond, Virginia, and it's an artsy town. I'm in an area where there's 29,000 college kids at VCU right in this area, all around restaurants and just quaint. And they also have a theater here. So I go to a lot of these theaters. I like to watch the plays and so forth. So a couple of years ago, I decided to write a play. And I wrote this play, and I went over to the Barksdale Theater here, and they invited me to be once a month we come and we read scripts. So I have to write a script, what one guy does what, and what the other guy does that, and so forth. And then in 6 months, they take it downtown to the Firehouse Theater, and we have people who donate their time, and then you put this little first act on, and your second act, and your third act, and so forth. So that's what I'm doing.
Oh.
Would you like to hear what it's about?
Yeah.
It's called The Dressing Room. Stanley Weston says you can't get in the dressing room. Now, if you buy a ticket to my theater and you sit down and you read this little program that I used to put out all the time, it'll say, this show is about a dressing room, a wrestling dressing room. Nobody's ever been able to get in it. What happens in the dressing room? Is there any skullduggery going on? How do they handle it? What goes on? And it says at the bottom, it says, for the 33 years I've been in the business and the 31 years my dad's been in the business, a lot of these things that happen in the dressing room will be put in the first act. And there's only two acts. First act is 45 minutes. And then you have a 20-minute intermission. I've been in these plays. I'm saying it. They draw 900 till Johnny Heidemann used to come over from Roanoke, Virginia, and come to Richmond, Virginia, and he and I would go to the plays. It's in that, you would get that Style magazine, and it's written in there also. Anyway, the blue program will state that this is a dressing room. This doesn't happen one night, but it's a conglomeration of things that happen over the years, 30, 40, 50 years or something. The first act will be what happens in the dressing room, and the second act will be the promoter who now comes on the second act, and he describes what's going to go on. Now, I wrote this play, and the play consists of you bought a ticket, and you've read that, and you're sitting there, and the curtain opens up. And it's just a regular stage. On the left-hand side are some benches. On the right-hand side are some benches. And in the middle there's a door. And every time that door opens up, you hear the crowd from upstairs. There's a way of doing it electronically. And you hear the people upstairs. And all of a sudden, this guy walks in, and he's an usher. And he goes to the left-hand side of the stage, and he drops some programs. He goes to the right-hand side of the stage and drops some programs. And he walks out. 20 seconds later, the door opens up. This young guy comes in with a Samsonite bag. Hey, it's a wrestler. Nothing said yet. He walks to the left-hand side. He sits down on the bench. He opens up the bag, takes out a newspaper, puts it down in front of his feet like Frank Hickey used to do, takes his shoes off, puts them to the side. He takes out some Indian feathers, just like Wahoo McDaniels. Beautiful big things. He puts it on his head and runs it back and forth. Now he lays it down on his right-hand side that the audience sees that it's an Indian dress. And now he goes into his bag and he takes this mirror, and he holds the mirror up. So you guys can visualize this. He says, this is what our business was like. And he's taking it because we've seen guys like in the dressing room. He takes up the mirror and he holds the mirror up. Excuse me. And he takes a big red piece of chalk out, and he puts the chalk back down, and he just puts his finger underneath his eye, and he's imitating what the chalk's going to look like. He's trying to make a design or something, and just then the door opens up, and two big heels come in. Look like Jerry Graham. Big, heavy-set guy with blonde hair, and they stop, and they stare at this young new kid. and then they go to the right-hand side of the stage real slow, and they sit down. You hear that voice come on now when the door opens up. And one of the guys starts to pick up his program, and he opens up the program. He looks on the lower left-hand side. Then he glances over across the stage, and he looks at the young kid looking in the mirror. And he goes back again, and he looks at the program. He looks back at the kid, and he hollers at the kid. He says, "Hey, what match are you on?" Kid says, "I'm on first." And the big blonde looks back at the program, and he says, "What are you tonight?" The kid says, "I'm an Indian." The big guy looks at the program and says, "It says here you're from Calcutta, India." And the kid says, "Oh." So he takes the chalk and he turns to the audience and takes that round chalk and he puts it right in the middle of the forehead and he twists it and he makes that little butt. Little red thing in the forehead. Takes the tape off of his knee that he's got on his knee already and wraps it around the head. Now he's got a turban. I don't hear any laughter. Everybody I told that damn story to, they all laugh.
Well, I was into the story. I'm thinking, this is great. He went from a red Indian to the dark. That was very good, the way it was done. It was very good.
Oh, wait. That proves one thing to me. You guys are professionals. The ones that have been talented, my marks. They're the ones that buys the tickets. Yeah. What's that, Jerry?
No.
You know the funny thing about it? They all talk about Barnett. And it says in the program that Barnett's the biggest promoter. And, you know, Barnett really looked like Woody Allen, talked like Truman Capote. And now in the 45 minutes that they have the wrestlers coming in and whatever they do and whatever they say, and they're all talking about Barnett, astronomical guarantees from Australia and Indianapolis and so forth. The audience is going to believe that this man is the most powerful man. Well, he's the biggest thing. He's had TV in Indianapolis, and he promoted Dick the Bruiser to the top, and he had the Detroit Olympia sold out all the time, and Barnett, and all of a sudden, at the 45-minute mark, just before the intermission goes, because in the theater business, if you can't hold those people, they go for the 20-minute intermission, and when you come back for the second act, usually it's a half arena, and everybody moves down the front. It's very hard to hold, and I found this out by watching these things. So how am I going to be able to have these people stay for the second act 20 minutes later? When everybody hears that Barnett, here comes Barnett, here comes Barnett. There's about eight people, wrestlers all dressed and so forth in the dressing room. And here comes Woody Allen in, walking across the stage like a gay person, saying, "Oh, my God, these are my champions. Let's get the first match on the road." Close the curtain. Now, don't tell me somebody's going to go home. Going to say, "What the hell is this guy going to do with these big wrestlers?" And I'll tell you why I got that idea. I went to seven plays here in Richmond in about 2 years. And on four of them, I walked out. Even before but one play they had this guy in a wheelchair. And he had his hand twisted. His hand was underneath his chin, and his knuckles were twisted that way. He was pinching his cheek, and he was slobbering like crazy. And his head was twisted sideways, and he was in his wheelchair slumped, and you knew he was paraplegic. And for the 45 minutes, his mother pushed him across the stage, and she had some dialogue with her aunt, and then the brother-in-law came in, and they pushed him over in the corner, and he's still sitting there, and they captured the play on the right-hand side and forgot about him. And finally, after 45 minutes, they wheeled him out in the front, and the mother and the sister-in-law argued, and they walked off, and I waited about 10 seconds, and this kid sits up out of this wheelchair and looks at the audience, straight his hands out, and says, "I wonder what they're going to do to me the second act." And he goes right back to the same position, puts his hand on, and he there says, "I ain't leaving." They got me. I realize in that kind of business, the theater business, they even have some Barksdale Theater is a dinner theater. They'll have a stage and they'll have all around with tables and chairs and having dinner while you're acting. They'll have one act like 5 minutes and then you close down and they'll have drinks and so forth and you act two coming up in 10 minutes. And it's a play, live people. Some of it's boring, some of it's great. But I got so many things going. My dad told me back in the 1930s, Ray Steele was his real good friend. And Ray Steele had a habit of carrying a hammer and a pair of nails and put them in his wrestling bag. And the first one to come in the dressing room was usually the referee, And he was the last one to leave that night because he had five matches to do. Well, we went out for that first match. He says, Ray, would you go over there? And where the referee's shoes was, he take those hammers, and he hammered the shoes to the floor. And he laughed like crazy. He'd go back and put the hammer away. And he was known for that. Anyway, that's my play.
Well, if we get up that way, we'll come see it, by God.
No, that's never going to get off the ground that quick. It takes 6 months before they allow you to have a demonstration. But anyway, it's interesting because I went to one of the readings and watched them. It's just like our business. They do it with words. And by the way, wrestling does it with words today. We used to tell a story. You know, our age in the wrestling business, I would grab your leg, Jerry, and then you would grab my arm. And 10 minutes later, I'm still after your leg because you got out a couple of times and kicked me off, and I went around and got it a different way, and you got my arm. It's a story. Now when you watch WWE and the thing comes on, there's not a match for 20 minutes because one wrestler comes out there with a microphone and the other one comes out there with a microphone, and they verbally have a verbal match. And then they wind up with acrobats. The best thing to do when you watch WWE, if you really want to criticize them, is turn the volume off and just watch. If you don't see more errors, I mean, it's unbelievable. When you hear the voice, you know, the five senses. One of them is the voice, so when the commentator starts to tell you and screams, or look at that, well, your mind is on what he's saying and not the intelligence that you have if you shut the volume off to say, wait a minute, that's impossible. That's not right. The guy dives through the rope. Instead of looking at the guy diving through the rope, watch the guy standing up. He's watching them just like a balloon coming through the air, and he throws those hands up, and he times it just perfect. Beautiful acrobats.
That's what they are. That's what it is today. There's no storytelling.
But I'll tell you one thing, Billy, and I'll tell everybody and the fans and the people at the newspaper and on TV and everything else, and I'll tell you this. In 40 years from now, here's what you tell some of these fans. In 40 years from now, you, the fan, who is like 35 years of age, I said, well, he'll be 75 years of age, and you'll be watching TV, and you'll be watching wrestling, and you'll turn around to one of your relatives and say, God, this is crazy. Why wasn't it just as good as it was back in 2011? And that's what's happening now. And it was the promoter's fault for educating the 15 and the 16-year-old kid who went to the wrestling matches when they had a job, and they went bowling on Friday night, and they went to the wrestling match on Saturday night. That was my era. You had the young couples out in the audience, 18, 19 years of age, second row, every week. And after about 6 months, you don't see them anymore because they went into something else, bowling or something else. But the promoters had to bring in more, so they had to exaggerate more. It's whatever the traffic would allow. And so we educated the fans. My dad told me years ago when Ed Spangler-Lewis got that headlock on somebody, he had the reputation of holding it, and nobody got out. So after about 6 months of him making the loop all around the United States, when he got the headlock after about 15 minutes of a match, they got up and left, the people, put the hat on and walked out. It's the truth.
I believe it.
Because they said, why should we wait it out for another 20 minutes? The SOB never got, nobody ever got out of it. The creator of the monster.
Very true.
I know we're getting close on time, but Dick said something when he's talking about that play. He said they got me. I got to give you a Charlie Smith story.
Okay.
He went to Charlie's going to all these little independent shows selling gimmicks now. He's got him a.
Right.
I mean, he sells just anything. He sells masks, anything he can sell, you know. So he goes to a show here 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they were raffling off a TV, and the story was the TV was being raffled off for somebody's hospital bill or something. So Charlie says he bought $2 worth of tickets, you know. So he says they go through the whole night and they get ready to raffle the thing off, you know, and they draw the thing. And the lady that was sitting over that was taking care of the TV, as soon as they announce the number, she jumps up and hollers, wait, I won. And Charlie told me, he says, they got me. Then they worked the drawing.
As many times as Charlie's done that himself, he should have.
Oh,
exactly.
Let me tell you. Let me tell you what his deal, this thing he did. There was a chain of stores around the Southeast called Steve and Barry's. They were actually all around the country. And they would buy they would buy collegiate apparel. They would buy seconds or something that had a little something wrong with them, and they sold them for almost nothing. So Charlie, of course, has been working football games for years, and he would go buy this stuff at Stephen Berry's for almost nothing, then take it and sell it and make a pretty good profit. So he came up with the deal. He would go to the wrestling matches, and he would take three sweatshirts. He would hang up one from Georgia, one from Alabama, one from Florida, and he would sell chances on a sweatshirt $1 a piece. And he said, at the end of the night, we're going to draw, and whoever wins gets a sweatshirt. He was making $150, $200, $250 a night on an $8 sweatshirt. I mean, he's
made in China.
Oh yeah, probably so. But if he, that's just he's Charlie is if there's a way to make a buck, he knows how to do it. But yeah, those were his exact words. That lady stood up and hollered, "I won the TV." Charlie said, "They got me."
We're getting short on time here, but Bill mentioned that he in the past has worked with Gold Brother Circus, and a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't realize till Ron West told me that you actually started with the circus in Australia.
1960 in Australia, sure did. Used to look after the elephants. Elephant trainer, as they say. Good old days when you could fucking do all kinds of things to them. Now you go keep them in air-conditioned buildings, and you go have shade over them, and they go to have water 24/7 and all kinds of things. That Peter people, man, they are very hard on circuses today.
Oh, yeah.
The animal rights people, God, it's just, oof.
Well, actually,
and they'll come to that circus and say, "How are you looking after the elephants and the lions and the tigers?" And they'll never ask once, "How are you looking after the little Mexicans that put the tent up?" Nobody ever asks.
Yep. Mm. I was going to say, my first town is next week, and it's one of your former towns, Monticello. So if I make it through there, I guess I still got a job with Old Brothers. Any advice you can give me?
Are you really me? Are you actually going to Cole Brothers? Or?
I'm here. I've been with them over a month now. I'm in Middletown, New York right now. Monticello is my first show next week.
Oh, the guy's a big wrestling fan, the DJ up there. What the hell is his name?
Guy Thunder, yeah. They wouldn't They wouldn't let us. They didn't want us this year. They told us we couldn't deal with any other radio stations. We already had some others lined up, so we ended up not dealing with him. So,
I was there, man, they did all kinds of shit for us.
Yeah, that's what they said.
He was a very big time wrestling fan.
You were popular at the Indian Reservation too.
Yes, I was. The squaws liked me. Yeah, wait till you get there, brother, and you see. And that's what it's called, the Shinnecock Indian Reservation Nation. They run it themselves. There's no, it's kind of just in a different country. And you're right there in Long Island, New York. And it's run by the Indians.
Right now. What tribe are they? Do you know, Bill, what tribe they are?
Do what?
The
Shinnecock.
Okay.
Whatever that is, it's called the Shinnecock Indian Nation, so I guess that's what they are, the Shinnecock, whatever you call it.
I thought it was the Iroquois or the Semi-Hole.
What was it Joe Scarpa was when he was Jason Rombo, a Sicilian? Well, guys, I'm going to wrap it up. Bill, I really appreciate your time tonight. And anytime you want to be on, you've got an open mic. As Dick can tell you, he's been with us several times. We're going to have him back on in a couple of weeks. He never.
All right, when I get my book finished by Christmas, I'll call y'all to see if we can sell it somewhere.
Dickie, it was nice talking to you, brother. I ain't talked to you in 30 years since you sent me out to the audience with my suit on with no hair. That fucker standing laughing like a... But anyway, it was a good rip.
Hey, I'll see you in Nashville. I'm coming down to Scott Peel's deal.
Oh, you going? Okay, that'll be good. I'm going too. I never used to go to them things, but I went last year, and I really enjoyed myself going back.
Yeah, okay.
I'll be looking for you down there.
All right. Good to talk to you.
And gentlemen, you take care, and you take care on the circus. Don't let Renee get to you too much.
Oh, no, we're doing fine, man. I appreciate it, though.
Well, good. If you need any help, just holler at me. And, Dickie, I'll see you in, the end of September and the 1st of October, right?
Yeah.
Hi, Jay. All right, pal.
Well, I'll see you, too.
All right, glad you all take care. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bobby and Jerry, as always, I appreciate you guys. And we will do this again next week if I can figure out how to work this switchboard system. And we'll see what kind of trouble we can get in. I think I have to come up with – it's been a while since it's just been the three of us, so I'll have to try and come up with something just the three of us can talk about next week and give ourselves – put ourselves over for a while, for a change. And that'll do it for tonight's show, and we will talk to you guys next week. Thanks.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.